I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Jen Ag joins me now. She's written one of the more engaging, necessary, and entertaining books of the year. It's a memoir about her work in the restaurant business, where she's made quite a name for herself in Toronto. Her popular establishments include the Black Hoof, Cocktail Bar, Rum Corner, and Grey Gardens. She's often hilarious and frank and honest about the sexism and double standards in the restaurant business and society itself. The book is called I Hear She's a Real Bitch, and even with her confidence, she bears her vulnerability in equal measure. The book is published by Doubleday. Jen Ag lives in Toronto, but she joined me from Vancouver earlier this week. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Jen Ag. Ms. Ag, good morning.
Good morning. You can call me Jen.
I can call you Jen. Yeah, I'll do
yeah.
that. And that's the thing about reading this book is one gets almost too familiar with you that I'm thinking to myself, there's nothing I can't ask you. Was there anything you left out, say?
I left so much out, but I mean, I left it out for a reason.
Yeah. The other thing that I'm thinking about as I'm reading the book, because you're obviously such a busy person, is were you able to find the time to actually sit down and write this?
And clearly.
How, yeah.
But I managed to.
But how were you, though?
You know, I found my best route to actually getting words on a page was really taking myself out of my environment. Like, I couldn't, I found even trying to write at home in Toronto, you know, taking a day where I wouldn't go into the restaurant, say, until 7 or 8 o'clock at night and trying to, you know, block out 5 or 6 hours. I just couldn't do it. There was always some distraction or something I needed to pay attention to, and I could pay attention to because, you know, I was in Toronto. So I found the train between Toronto and Montreal to be a really conducive environment. I would know that I would have 5-hour blocks, you know, twice a week, because I was going back and forth between Toronto and Montreal every single week, and I would have 10 hours a week, and I could get, you know, a lot done in that time. But my favorite thing was to actually go to a different place, and I did a lot of writing on a beach, which was really bourgeois and wonderful, and I did a lot of writing at a friend's house in upstate New York. So it was when I was able to get out of my space where I could kind of really calm down my brain and try and focus, because one of my biggest problems, as you'll see as we have this conversation, is that I get a little bit tangential, and everything is a many-pronged answer to a simple question where you'll be like, did she even answer my question? Which is kind of what I'm doing now, and just rambling on and on and on. So I really do need to, like, you know, take a minute and have a breath, and like that. And I found I couldn't do that in Toronto. So that was my methodology.
Now, the standard in the double standard in the restaurant business, is it really better now than, say, 15 years ago? And what do you think it'll take to sort of bridge that or get rid of it?
I don't know that it's better. I mean, I think it's hard to argue that we're not in some ways, you know, always kind of culturally moving forward. Although when you look around, you know, what's happening in America right now and just sort of seeing racists unmasked and like all, you know, literal Nazis and who the president is and all that stuff, you know, it does certainly make you think, no, actually we're not moving forward. And, you know, my favorite thing that a lot of my black friends will say is, you know, how are you surprised? Like, mm-hmm. This isn't a surprise. And it's not really a surprise to me. And I don't know that things are really getting better quickly enough. Not for my taste. I like things that happen fast. And the restaurant industry is sort of a creaky old barge of a boat, and it does not respond fast enough. So I never get my hopes up that, you know, that these supposed watershed moments are actually going to shed anything.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing that I was, as I was reading the book, the sort of bro culture won't be done away with fast enough, especially when you have a president like the one who's in office now, and that's the sort of rhetoric that he uses from such a powerful place.
Yeah, I mean, bro culture isn't just something that exists in the restaurant business, of course, you know, and that's what you're saying. It's everywhere. It's the water we swim in. It's the air we breathe as women. The world is built for the comfort, stability, and accommodation of men and their needs. Even something, you know, as simple as how office buildings are kept at a temperature that is comfortable for men, and all women that work in office buildings know they have to bring a sweater. And that just seems like the tiniest, stupidest, no big deal thing. But when you start to multiply that, and you start to see really the double standards that exist, how women are judged for, you know, similar actions as men. You know, men doing something get kind of rewarded for it, and women get like criticized for it. It's really difficult to take and to, you know, keep fighting against it.
Do you think it's helpful when people talk about what feminism is and the difference of what it means from one person to another? I mean, that internal debate. Do you think we're hung up on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think any conversation about feminism is helpful. You know, I mean, sometimes people might kind of stumble and say the wrong things or what, like, who's deciding who the wrong things and the right things are. Like, my favorite thing is when women get on each other about feminist being wrong. Mm. And, you know, that's not helpful. You know, and I think this isn't really what you asked, and this is kind of what I meant, where I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to talk about this other thing. That to me, that is like the most difficult conversation and the one that I really want to have. But at the same time, you know, we have to talk about men assaulting women and teaching men not to rape instead of women not to wear short skirts. And that's definitely a priority. And that's a thing that we should be talking about. But at the same time, you know, women are also complicit in the patriarchy, and that's a difficult conversation. So, you know, but having the conversations is extremely important. And I'm starting to see, and I don't want to let myself get hopeful, but I'm starting to really feel like we actually this time for real might be in a watershed moment.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, but you see, you do that to yourself too in the book when you say that you're wondering if you're a bad feminist for wanting a wedding.
Oh, I mean, a lot of those asides are just me kind of anticipating how people are going to react to what I'm saying and being like, no, I'm just going to say it first, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
So you can't say it.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking a moment ago when you were saying, you know, how to change the culture. I mean, there are a lot of women who are anti-feminists today.
Sure,
and so how do you talk to them? Or do you even?
You know, it's funny. Okay, my husband not too long ago asked me how I would deal with a woman who was ostensibly progressive, by all accounts, you know, seemed forward-thinking, blah, 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 but was anti-abortion. And I was like, nope, she's not progressive.
Mm.
That's not a thing. And I was really kind of adamant about it. And his argument, and my husband is someone who occasionally checks in with Fox News because he wants to know what the enemy is thinking. So he can be like a little bit more objective a thinker sometimes than I can be. And I'm definitely ruled by like reactionary thoughts and anger about things not being good enough or the way that I think they should be, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I mean, it's difficult because I'm already in an echo chamber. My Twitter feed is curated. My Instagram feed is curated. The people that are interested in what I have to say, you know, are already there. And I mean, the kind of people that are going to come to the book are presumably, you know, like-minded people, politically or whatever. So, you know, there's this whole other faction. There's like 50% of people, maybe more, mm-hmm. that think in a different way. And I don't know that it's my job to keep trying to reach out. You know, I'm not a politician,
yeah.
and I don't like being identified as one. And I'm also sick of telling people, like, how to be better at whatever. You know, the sort of thing that's coming up now a lot with women is we're sick of explaining to men, like, how to be better. Like, figure it out. Do the work. Like, we're tired of doing the heavy lifting. And I sort of feel similarly about, you know, the question that you asked me about reaching across to people who maybe don't think about things the same way I do. It'd be interesting maybe to have a conversation, but, you know, it's hard to change people's minds when they've got something that they've grown up with or they think about women in a certain way. And I don't really, again, I don't think it's my job to change their mind. It's their job.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you're being asked as you tour this book, but by male interviewers, what they should do better. I mean, I'm just expecting that's the sort of question that you'd get, is it?
I don't think anyone actually has asked me that question. I mean, I'd probably respond similarly and be like,
yeah.
you know, start, like, reading and giving a shit and, like, paying attention
yeah.
to women. Like, is that so complicated?
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe stop treating them like sex objects and they're for your amusement and entertainment. And, you know, not you, Joe. I don't know you. I don't make assumptions that that's what you're doing. But I mean, a lot of men do kind of, and this is another real problem within, see, this is the thing. This is my third or fourth interview. So now I'm just like, yeah, fuck it. I'm just going to say whatever I want.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So
yeah.
Now we're in a point where we're talking about, like, I like to call them liberal arts males. the allies that we think are on our side, and you know, and when you start, and certainly Weinstein was a perfect example of somebody whose outward facing messaging did not match
right. The
you know, the wolf that lived within the sheep's clothing, or whatever mixed metaphor you'd like me to dish out for you. And that's a real problem too, is here you have men that are, by all accounts, you know, on side, but really they're not. And it's so difficult. It's so, you know, I'm surrounded by wonderful men who I love dearly and are it-getters, as I like to say. But I do think that oftentimes men like that are the exception.
Mm-hmm. You know, and
buy my book, men.
Yeah, well, I think that isn't that a great place to start, because I'm reading the book, and one of the things that I find myself just admiring you for is this confidence, and I'm wondering where that comes from. Are you equal parts your mom and dad, say, in that regard?
Well, I mean, first of all, you try being born with one tit and see how you have to manufacture confidence pretty quickly. That's definitely a starting point for it. But I also think I am my father's daughter, and you know, I love both my parents. My mom's dead, and it's an awful thing to have to go through. And my dad has Alzheimer's, which is equally awful in a different way. But I'm more like my dad than my mom, and my brother's more like my mom, and. He was like that. He just had this sort of natural, one of my favorite stories that he used to tell me was when he went to, University of Western, he had no money, and he worked his way through school peeling potatoes, literally peeling potatoes for rich kids to, enjoy French fries.
Oh.
And he would stand in the back of the kitchen peeling these potatoes all morning long before class and like look out at these, called them these rich douchebags, and he said, you know, I want to leave them in the dust. And so I have a little bit in me, you know, genetically, to kind of, everything's a competition, to want to win. But you know, yeah, the confidence is certainly, I do recognize that I probably am a pretty confident person, and I think, you know, you kind of, it's a combination of just like natural, genetic, blah, 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 but also just needing to be that way as a woman in the world. Because if you're not, then, you know, it's harder to get people to pay attention to what you're saying. And if you think what you're saying has any value or any merit, you have to say it loudly and proudly, you know?
Yeah, that's the other thing, too, in the book, is that I guess because you are as confident as you are, you're able to show your vulnerability as it is, and not care, not give a shit about what you leave out there.
Oh, thanks. That's really nice to notice, and I agree. I think there is a lot of vulnerability in the book, and I think it is important for women and men, and really for men to start being comfortable with vulnerability, because it's not a weakness.
Yeah. No, indeed. And the other thing that I'm reading, and you've mentioned Roland already, your husband, how I'm sure a lot of men and women are looking at the two of you and saying, I want that when I grow up.
That's so sweet. I do. You know, a lot of we have a lot of younger people around us just by nature of our industry.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of kids, when they sort of are coupling off, will just sort of point to us and say, like, relationship goals. And it's very cute. And, you know, I feel very lucky. I feel like we both want to be together. And we love each other in a real, real deep way. And I don't think that is usual. And I don't think everyone gets that. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, that's why I also think that if you're in a mediocre relationship, you're better off being alone than, you know, kind of settling. But I understand why people stay sometimes.
Yeah. In this time where we're talking about Harvey Weinstein, we're talking this week about Bill O'Reilly. We just are seeing the hashtag Me Too. When recent events like this happen, when news stories of this magnitude happen, do you think it's easier for people to talk about the abuse that they've experienced, and for bystanders to say, do something to call it out, or do we just once all this passes, we go back to say what it was?
Yeah, I'm just working on a piece about that very thing, and I really want to believe. And you know, the more, to date, like, I'm Dana Scully here. Was it Mulder or Scully who wanted to leave? It was Mulder. You guys know all about them here in Vancouver. In previous moments like this, as we always call them, watershed moments.
Yeah, teachable moments and things, yeah.
Yeah, teachable moments. I would get my hopes up, and then all the people involved would just get bad apples, and we would move on, and everything would go back to normal, and then the same thing would happen. But the frequency with which it's happening now, and the power of, I mean, I don't personally think women need to or should have to share what was perhaps the most humiliating, awful experience of their life for men to understand how complicit they are. I don't think that's fair, but it seems to be the thing that we have. Courts are failing women in terms of sexual assault. Almost always courts fail women. So, you know, conservative men always get so up in arms about the court of public opinion, but like, what fucking route should we take?
Right.
If deterrent and naming and shaming seems to be the only thing stopping these types of men from this type of behavior. And I mean, that's not a good enough reason. If the only thing stopping you from raping someone is the fear that she'll tell, you know, you've got bigger problems.
Yeah.
But it does seem to be the thing that is maybe be more effective, and it makes you wonder, you know, in a time before, like, social media has had such a profound change on our culture, it makes you wonder what was happening when there was no connectivity. Men were just like raping and pillaging at their leisure, and it was probably super normal. Like, at least now there's a little bit of shame around it. I don't think men tell each other about their rape scores, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I can imagine, you know, hundreds of years ago that probably was stories that would be shared around campfires while cooking rabbits or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you write about the setbacks, personally and professionally, the unpleasantness in your life, pain in your life, is it at all cathartic for you and say, you know, to use that silly phrase, to move on?
Oh, my God, yes. Like, absolutely. There, one particularly cathartic moment for me was writing about the high school sort of crush friend that I had, who I was kind of obsessed with in high school, and who treated me, like, horribly.
Uh-huh.
But writing about it was really helped me kind of, you know, not that it's not something that I was sticking in my brain as an adult, but I would see him, you know, around downtown occasionally, and I would always want to sort of go up to him and say, do you realize, like, how awful you were to me and how not okay that was? And I never did, because I just thought, what's the point? Like, I don't want to talk to this asshole. But writing about it and, like, knowing that he's going to see it and our friends are going to see it, it felt really good, because at that time, you know, I'd had a few experiences. I don't think I wrote about all of them, but I definitely had some close calls in terms of, like, sexual assault moments in my teenage life, because I was, just like a teenager, and that's the kind of, like, I know, this is the thing, I know every woman I know has a story, so somebody's doing it, you know, it can't just be, like, 5% of men, more.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had a couple stories like that, and I always found that even my girlfriends would sort of hold me responsible, like, well, you know, you should stop putting up with that, or, you know, you shouldn't have done this. It was like the instinct to blame ourselves amongst ourselves is disturbingly strong, or it certainly was 25 years ago. And I think, you know, it still is in some ways, and I think that's a big part of the problem.
The title of the book is something that has drawn so many readers in, and it's something that a lot of us who've read the book just enjoy a great deal. was that easy to get past your publisher, say?
You know, I kind of talked to my agent, Martha Webb, who's wonderful, and I said something, you know, to the effect of, this is a deal breaker, like, if they don't want the title, we're going somewhere else. And this is talking about, you know, Penguin Random House, a pretty powerful publishing house run by a pretty powerful woman, Kristen Cochran. And when I first met when I had my first sort of professional meeting with them, I kind of went in with this idea that I would have to fight for it, and they were just like, oh, no, we love the title. And I was like, okay, but, and also vagina in the book, no problem, great, okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they were actually so great with all of the envelope pushing that I wanted to do. And they let me art direct the cover. I'm really a little bit controlling. I don't know if that comes across. So, yeah, they were really amazing. It was a wonderful experience.
On a superficial level, because we've already talked about these important, necessary things that you write about.
We did all the hard stuff.
Yeah, it's a terribly useful book, and I'm thinking if one wants to open a restaurant, they ought to read this.
Yeah, I guess it is.
Yeah. Also, if one's a diner, as I am,
right.
Just the sort of things that we need to be thinking about as we're you know, sitting there and trying not to be an asshole to whoever's serving us, right?
That's a good first step. You know, you're already doing the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, I go out to dinner with people who are just nightmares, and I've realized, yeah.
I'll pick up with them, Joe.
Yeah.
For you and those people.
I need to find other people to go eat with, right?
It's actually so difficult. I was just talking about this with my, I have some friends in Vancouver who are also in the industry, and they're wonderful. And we were just talking about this yesterday, about how difficult it is to go out with non-restaurant people. Because as restaurant people, we just have a very specific way of dining. And I, you know, when you're with your people and they get it, it's just really easy to have a good time. But I find when I'm with people who, which is not often, to be honest, most of my friends are in the industry, when I'm with people who aren't or who don't get it, I get a little bit tense. I'm like, how are they going to be okay? And, like, if somebody's rude to a server, like, that's it, we're done, you know?
Mm. Yeah. Are there places that you like eating at here in Vancouver?
Absolutely. I've been saying it since I got here, that the level of service in Vancouver is so impressive, possibly the best in the country, by what I can see, and having spent, you know, my entire career in Toronto and now a little bit in Montreal, like the service level here, I think it can be explained by just like the training ground of the big corporations that you have here.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of like restaurants, I love Bao Bay. I love Tannis. I think it's just a wonderful, wonderful spot. And I was so sad I couldn't get to Kissa Tanto because the one night that I could go, they were doing a private event and it was just such a bummer. I had a really great meal last night at Savio Volpe.
Mm.
It was really, really delicious. I actually haven't had, that's it. That's pretty much, I've only been in town. Oh, in Hawksworth. I had like a really nice few plates at the bar at Hawksworth because I'm staying in the hotel and I was exhausted. But that's the only spots that I've been to this trip.
Yeah.
But I do love coming out here. This is my third trip out here in a few years. And I'm always like blown away by just the level of cocktails. I mean, the Diamond is amazing. Yeah, it's just it's a really good food town.
Yeah, we complain a lot about living here and how bloody expensive it is. Well, we get Toronto's the same way.
I think it's still more expensive here than Toronto in terms of like cost of living. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's what I hear all the time. Yeah, but we are blessed with you know some pretty good places to go eat.
I'm gonna try to go to Masayoshi tonight. Have you been there?
It's
a newish place.
Yes, I have been there.
Am I saying it right? Yeah.
Yeah, I have been there.
Yeah, I just want to eat some really good sushi before I leave town because I think it's kind of blasphemous to not do that.
Yeah, and I've been places like L.A. and things like that, and people have told me for years that our sushi is just as good as anywhere else.
Oh, and for sure it is. I've had amazing sushi here.
Yeah. How's handling a book review and reading that? Is that like a restaurant review?
So I've been very fortunate to have mostly positive reviews, and the one review where there was like a couple of real digs, it landed on a nice note, and I understood why she did it. So, you know, I just took my hits like a champ. I mean, of course, it's like it's nerve wracking in a different way because this is all me. Like, at least with the restaurant, you know, I'm usually partnered or employing a chef. So but certainly that is, you know, an equal part of the experience.
There's someone else to blame.
Well, yeah, I mean, we can kind of take it together, you know, like this is not, but this book it's just me. And so putting it out there, Yeah, I mean, I don't get nervous a lot. But I was, definitely, and especially for the American release where, you know, when we're in a place like Canada, this small country sitting above this, you know, cultural giant juggernaut, we tend to kind of, it's like if you don't get the anointment of America, it's hard. It's hard here for that. You kind of know what I'm getting at, right?
Yeah,
I kind of
say
it carefully, but I'm too tired to be smarter about it. But yeah, I mean, so I was really nervous with the book release there and how, you know, when I didn't have the same kind of built-in audience that I did in Toronto and how easy that was because, you know, I already have a career there. I'm already known there and I'm known in the restaurant industry throughout the country, I think. Certainly feels like that, which is nice. But it's different in the States. So, yeah, it was definitely a couple of sleepless nights.
And you still do shifts at the restaurant hosting?
Oh, yeah, I do. I mean, I'm at Grey Gardens a lot right now because we're still in year one.
Uh-huh.
So I usually go in mid-service and stay till the end because I really enjoy just touching base with the team. And the same at the Hoof. I less so maybe at Cocktail Bar, which kind of just runs itself. But I always check in on the weekends, Rum Corner and Cocktail Bar, and then we go to Montreal a couple times a month. So it's really important to have eyes on your business.
Yeah.
It really, really is.
Yeah, it's a terrible question because I know you've just written this and you're promoting it. But as someone who's enjoyed it a great deal, will you continue to write? Is there something that you're working on now, like say another book?
I want to get better at writing essays, so that's what I'm going to focus on right now. I think I have I write essays how I answer questions, which is, you know, long-winded and tangential, and I need to get better at trying to focus my words in and more bang for your buck instead of these, like, long, rambling things that I really need my hand held in editing. So I really want to focus on that. I do think I will probably write another book, and it will probably be a memoir-style book, but I got to live a little more life first, you know?
Mm. But, you know, your life thus far in this book is such an enjoyable read, and despite it all, I mean, did you look back and think it was worth it all? I mean, even though there was some bad stuff.
Absolutely, I wouldn't change a thing. I mean, yeah. I think every bad thing that has ever happened to me, or that I've ever allowed to happen, or that I've ever done as a bad person for moments in my life, you know, it taught me stuff. Like it taught me stuff about who I am and how I maybe should react to a situation differently, and it taught me the kind of blind spot that I have for certain kinds of men. Like all of these things were part of what made me mature enough to, at 29, you know, fall in love with somebody who really was my intellectual equal, who was, you know, considerably older than I was at the time. But if I hadn't had all those experiences, I definitely wouldn't have been really emotionally or intellectually prepared to be in a relationship of total equality.
I've so enjoyed this book, as I've said, in talking to you. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much, Joe. Those were really wonderful questions, and I really appreciate it. And I'd love if you can send me a link so, you know, I can share it with my audience.
The book is called I Hear She's a Real Bitch. It's published by Doubleday. Jen Egg, its author, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.